You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Welcome to the Cycling Podcast. Joining me, Graham Wilgos, for our fourth Attitude Camp episode on the Tuesday of the week before we head out to Barcelona for the Tour de France's Grand Départ is the Boulanger of Not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Graham. I should perhaps explain that one. During the UK's extreme heat wave that we're enjoying or enduring at the moment, I spent yesterday on a bread bakery course. Not content with 3 weeks on the road in France enjoying the croissants and the baguettes and the brioche, I thought I'd polish up my own bread baking skills. Spent all day slaving over dough and hot ovens. Really enjoyed it, actually. But I'll be judging all of France's bakery over the duration of the Tour de France. I've got some very high standards now.
I was going to say, I'm very impressed by your De Niro-esque preparation, your dedication to being race ready, sort of before we face France full on and embracing one of its finest traditions. But from the picture that you showed me, you have become an artisan baker very, very close to our departure.
Overnight. I learned some skills, Graham. You know, I'd kind of been muddling along and then an expert showed me where I'd been going wrong. And yeah, I feel like I've improved. It's like anything, isn't it? If somebody knows what they're doing, gives you some tips and hints, it can develop your own skills. So yeah, very glad I did it. And as I mentioned, the heat wave, I mean, it is sweltering here in the UK. I think this is not just Attitude Camp, but it's a acclimatization camp. I think we may well be in for a very hot Tour de France, especially the start. Bordeaux, which is on the route, is scheduled this week or forecast this week to have temperatures touching 40 degrees. I mean, cooling is going to be a critical part of the preparation for the daily stages for the riders, but I suspect also for ourselves. We may have to invest in a cool box from Decathlon, throw a few euros Paul Sexsass's way and get ourselves a cool box for the car.
Indeed, yeah. It's the same week, of course, that Lea Wilcox has just had to abandon her round the world record attempt just because of the European heatwave, because it's too hot. It made me wonder about whether or not we would see, or the likelihood of, the extreme weather protocol at the Tour. But long-range forecast, actually, because I had a quick peek, and I know that can still change. But after that first sort of that start, and up to the start in Barcelona, I mean, and sort of over the Pyrenees and into that little corner of Bordeaux, after that we should be all right. Should be around the 30 degree mark.
Maybe this is the heat wave now, and the Tour de France will be relatively manageable. Obviously, cooling strategies is something that we can investigate when we get there and talk to some of the teams, because we know a lot of work is done on that to try and keep the core temperature of riders down before they start the stages and during the stages. The feeding protocols, you know, getting the energy into the riders is one thing, but also getting cold liquid into and onto the riders to keep those temperatures down, absolutely critical when they're trying to perform at their very best. So that may be one of the stories of the Tour in the early days, but fingers crossed it isn't too extreme for the full duration. I'm not built for it. My sort of British Irish genes, I'm a bit too fair and gingery and grey these days for extreme heat.
I wasn't going to say anything,
but there we go. You look much more comfortable, you know, much more. You've got to, you know, you sort of look comfortable in the heat, Graham. You know,
so. I've got that sort of Celtic heritage too, Welsh heritage on my mum's side. Someone who won't, of course, be having to worry about the heat in France or any extreme weather protocol is Wout Van Aert. Some of the big news in a big old week of racing that we'll get onto shortly. Wout van Aert will not be racing the Tour de France because of the elbow injury that saw him withdraw from the Not Dauphiné, the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes.
Yeah, a big blow for Van Aert and a big blow for Visma Lisebike as well. I mean, I thought he started a bit slowly in the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. You know, you forecast that he might win a stage, which of course he did in Villars-les-Dombes. And then the next day he didn't start because of this persistent elbow issue relating to a crash and injury in training before the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, and he will miss the Tour de France, which is a real shame for him and for the team, especially with that team time trial on the opening day in Barcelona, where it's going to be a real clash of the titans, isn't it, between Visma-Lisa Bike and UAE Team Emirates, and both teams will want the strongest possible lineup. So losing Van Aert, who is a very good time trialist in his own right, a very strong rider, is a blow for them. And it's the first Tour de France he'll miss since he made his debut in 2019. And I was looking back at that, and I remember that race really well. But just how much he'd burst onto the scene that year. He'd had that kind of fractious transfer from Verandas Willems Krellen to Jumbo-Visma, as they were then. You know, he joined them in, you know, the season was already underway. And he had an absolutely blistering start to his time with them. He finished third at Strade Bianche, sixth at Milan-San Remo, second in the E3 Bink Bank Classic. And then he won a couple of stages at the Dauphiné, as it was called then, and went into the Tour de France as kind of this young, fresh sensation, was part of the Jumbo-Visma team that won the team time trial in Brussels and put Mike Tournison into the yellow jersey. Well, he was already in the yellow jersey, wasn't he? Because he'd won the stage the day before. So off to a fantastic start. And then, of course, he won a stage in his own right in Albi. Really memorable stage win. You know, Wout van Aert at his kind of best, really, sprinting at the end of a tough, rolling, transitional stage. But then his debut tour came to that sort of shattering end when he crashed in the time trial in Po, really nasty crash into the barriers, injured his leg pretty badly. But he's been a fixture in the tour since then, and he's won multiple stages. He won the green jersey in 2022. He's done some fantastic teamwork for Jonas Vingegaard over the years as well. And he's really the kind of, he's a totemic figure in that team, isn't he? Yes, Vingegaard is the rider targeting the yellow jersey, but Van Aert kind of sets the benchmark, really, I think. And we've seen him so often getting in early breaks in the mountains and doing all of that kind of unheralded work, which for you know, a really great classics rider, I think speaks volumes for him. You know, he kind of sets aside his own ambitions when it comes to the Tour de France, and rides very well for the team. So it'll be a big miss for Visma-Lisa Bike, for sure.
Huge miss. And particularly when you think of that 2022 race, the way that he had the freedom, certainly in the early parts of stages, to just go and animate the race straight away. And it just felt like he would do that day after day after day. And he made what could have been even quite pedestrian stages incredibly entertaining, just because he would pull the pin almost from kilometre zero. And of course, we saw him go toe-to-toe on the cobbles on the final stage last year. And his double ascent of Vontu stage win is also worth a mention while we're going over Wout van Aert's Tour de France palmarès. But that elbow injury that he sustained in a training crash prior to the artist formerly known as the Dauphiné is what's ruled him out, and there was a fear that he might have contracted sepsis, and so he's undergone surgery in order to be fighting fit, so he might well now be looking at the Vuelta late season, possibly. I mean, that's usually the way these things go, but he's only just back on the bike with the charity ride he did for the Olivia Fund a couple of days ago.
Yeah, I think you've summed it up there with that win over the Vontu into Malocène in 2021, wasn't it? But yeah, he's a rider who's won mountain stages, sprint stages, time trial stages of the Tour. He's won a conventional sprint on the Champs-Élysées, and as you say, last year, he was one of the few riders who really made Tadej Pogacar look ordinary, didn't he, on that stage into Paris over Montmartre. Fantastic, thrilling ride in the rain. So yeah, we'll miss him on a lot of levels, but Visma-Lisa Bike have got a gap to plug there for sure, and we'll probably talk in our preview next week about how they intend to do that. The other big news, because we're going to get on to the Tour de Suisse in the next part and talk about another Pogcineration, I think Daniel would describe it as, for Tadej Pogacar, ticking off the Tour de Suisse. But the big news, Matthew van der Poel, who spent a while in the time trial hot seat, stripped to the waist, his skin suit down to the waist. I mean, the big revelation is that he clearly doesn't use Alpacin shampoo on his chest, does he? What a magnificent specimen of a man.
I didn't see that coming.
Shall we get on with the racing?
I think that's the right thing to do.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. Now, how often do you think about your internet security? I must confess that since I became a NordVPN customer several years ago now, I barely give it a second thought because I know that NordVPN has got my back, keeping all of my internet connections safe and secure whenever I'm online, because one NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices. So I've got my laptop and phone, my iPad, smart TV, even our internet router is connected. And all of those connections are safe and secure, whether I'm at home or traveling around, dialing up to the internet, dialing up. No one dials up anymore, do they? Connecting up to the internet in hotels, as I will be doing at the Tour de France in a few weeks' time. It's really quick, so it doesn't slow down your internet connection. There are lots of other benefits too, but the primary one is keeping all of your data safe and secure when you're online. And that's really important when you're paying bills or logging onto your bank account. Anything like that, you don't want those details to be hijacked, but it will also protect you from viruses and phishing attempts and malware. You can get a great deal because you listen to the Cycling Podcast. You'll get 4 months extra for free if you sign up to a 2-year plan at nordvpn.com/TCP. That's nordvpn.com/TCP.
So Lionel Tadej Pogacar wins the Tour de Suisse. Not really belying anyone's expectations. His 121st career victory. I mean, these numbers are ridiculous. His 21st overall title. He took three stages and the overall for 13 wins in just 16 race days this season. Those are the numbers, but there's more to it than that. What did you make of it?
Well, I mean, he laid down the marker on the first day, didn't he, with a big break. It was a 5-day race, wasn't it? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The race has been kind of reshaped, reimagined, brought into line really with the women's Tour de Suisse so that both races are held on the same course on the same day. So women in the morning, men in the afternoon. The Cycling Podcast Feminine team will be going into the women's race in detail, so I won't spoil that here. We'll focus on Tadej Pogacar's win. The opening stage, he attacked and basically won the race on the first day, didn't he? It was the fourth longest successful solo break of his career. He's made this his trademark in the last 2-3 seasons, hasn't he? The only longer breaks that have netted him a victory, Strada Bianca in 2024 was 81.1 kilometres. 2 years later in the same race, 79.2 kilometres. The Euro road race he won last year, 75 kilometres. And then the opening day of the Tour de Suisse, 69.5 kilometres. And he won it in, well, rampaging fashion. 2 minutes 14 ahead of Richard Carapaz. Okay, it's not the deepest field, yeah, but it's still packed with very good, very strong riders and strong teams. Lots of riders who are hoping to force their way into their respective Tour de France team selections. Good climbers, well-organized teams, but no one had any answer. I mean, it was an absolute thrashing, wasn't it?
It really was, from start to finish. And he must feel like you and your daughter ticking off your World Cup stickers with the kind of the got need in terms of his ticking off the most historic, most prestigious 1 day, or sorry, 1 week races, stage races. So he's Paris-Nice, got Tirreno-Adriatico, got Volta Catalunya, got Itzulia Basque Country as his only need from the sort of the most prestigious, having won Romandy and now Swiss this year. And of course, he's previously won the Dauphiné, now the Tour of Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. It was a race as well that really played to his strengths in terms of his calendar, this reformatting and it only being the five stages. Tour de Suisse was, of course, one of the longer, if not the longest, and most difficult with the climb, certainly week-long world tour race on the calendar. That played to his strengths, but he's come out of it looking better than ever. And he was asked about this in a couple of his post-race interviews. And he basically said, there's not much to add. He used your, I'm going to use the super good klaxon, because he said that he'd done a lot of super good training. And he can now go away and spend a few days with his teammates at their altitude camp in Isla 2000, I think is where they're going, and then travel to Barcelona early next week. But he basically said, it's just 10 days or almost 2 weeks to go, so there's not much more you can do before that. Maybe some small specific training. He basically said he's in the best shape that he's ever been in. And there was a lovely moment. I'm going to fast forward to the final stage, where obviously come back and cover the stages in between. But Jaco Alula's Mauro Schmidt on his sort of poglification, is that what we're calling it? Is that what Daniel called it?
I think is his usual
pogcineration. Yeah. It's a roglification. Yeah. Sorry, isn't it? Yeah, Mauro Schmidt just gave him a little salute as he passed him, climbing his way to victory on the fifth and final stage too. But incredibly impressive. And what more can you say?
The opening stage really set that marker. I mean, I don't like being the sort of the Monday morning sports director, the armchair sports director, but he caught and passed Frederik de Vesnes, who'd been away as part of a earlier break. And I mean, he's a strong rider in his own right. He won that incredible stage in Milan where they held off the sprinters in the Giro d'Italia. Pogacar went alone, and there wasn't really any reaction, and a slow reaction even once he was away and up the road. It was almost like everyone sleptwalked a little into letting him do it, and the time gap grew and grew and grew, and there wasn't really a great deal of organization behind. And it does make me wonder, when they can see it happening, what can they do? And it's not a case of, well, react quicker. They clearly don't react quickly enough.
It's too late by then. If you say react quicker, it's far too late. You need to sort of see it coming so far off. But even if you can see it coming, you know, we saw Richard Carapaz for EF Education Easy Post sort of do his best to stick with him on a couple of occasions, but there is no sticking with him when he hits the accelerator like he does on those climbs.
But there wasn't even a sort of counter move behind, was there? It was almost like everyone just downed tools and let him get on with it. And I'm not saying that's what they what was going through their mind, but it does make me ask the question: what is everybody waiting for? I mean, we're not talking about huge 250k classics where there's caution and there's like, well, I know that we can't match that and we can't go with that for the next, you know, two and a half hours. We're talking about really short stages, short punchy stages. But again, that plays into Pogacar's hands, doesn't it? Because of that explosivity and the fact that he can maintain that high pace and just open up the gap. And then once the gap's open, it's not going to close. It was an extraordinary stage win. It meant the GC was basically done. I thought the best stage was stage two, because there was a big breaker away, or a reasonable size break away. They were still clear, a minute and a half coming into the final of 10, 15 kilometres. Pogacar took off behind and rode them down and almost did it, didn't he? I mean, that was absolutely thrilling, watching Romain Grégoire, it was, hold on to win the stage. I mean, I felt worried for him.
And he needed a punch at the end. You sort of could feel that, they could feel that Pogacar was coming, and it really was a bit of a nail-biter of a finish. Grégoire, of course, loves the Tour of Switzerland. We saw him win there last year too, in the pouring rain. I don't know if you remember that, and he was the kind of the hardest rider on a really tough day, just because of how hard the weather made it. But yeah, Pogacar was almost as greedy as we've ever seen him, in terms of just wanting stage after stage after stage.
On that occasion, at least Matthias Vacek of Little Trek did sort of go with him, and they were riding it down. The riders in that break, along with Grégoire, Marcel Camprubi of Pinarello, Bart Lemon of Visma Lisa Bike, Filippo Zanna of Sudal Quickstep, and Britain's Finlay Pickering of Jaco Alula. I mean, they can't have believed their luck that they were still away. They must have known that Pogacar was riding them down, but they cooperated really well to the finish, and Grégoire had the sprint. It was an absolutely perfect stage, real well-balanced course, great position of that last climb to keep it all in the balance coming into the finish. And I thought that, I mean, entertainment-wise, that was the pick of the bunch.
And a handful of seconds in it.
Indeed, yeah. And then the third stage, I mean, you know, Pogacar had a bit of a day off, and Jonathan Narvaez of UAE Team Emirates, his teammate, of course, won the sprint ahead of Zandro Marisa of Pinarello Q36.5. They were the survivors from an earlier break. I mean, UAE Team Emirates look incredibly impressive across the board. I mean, we don't yet know whether Narvaez will line up for the Tour, having ridden almost all of the Giro d'Italia, pulled out a couple of days from the end after crashing into a team bus, wasn't it? After a stage, he rode into a team bus looking down at his computer, I think he was. So we don't know whether Narvaez will be in the UAE Team Emirates lineup, but he's clearly in great form. Won a stage, and I mean, what can you say about the time trial? It was
another exciting time trial. It's the year where we get really excited about time trials, whether they are. And this, of course, was an ITT. The last time you and I were particularly animated about the team time trial format, or the new team trial format, was during the Not Dauphiné. But this was another thriller.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Mathieu van der Poel of Alpecin Premier Tech, I mean, he flew around the course, didn't he? It was a really impressive ride by him, you know, sort of pushing the limit on every corner, got himself into the hot seat. But then Pogacar came streaking round. I mean, it was very, very close on the line, 0.4 of a second. But Pogacar, I mean, it was written all over Van der Poel's face, wasn't it, as he saw the Pogacar hit the line on the screen in front of him and the clock stopped, realised he hadn't won it. He sort of put his head down. It was one of those. Must have been thinking, oh, not him again. You know, let me have one.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the few things that Mathieu van der Poel has not done in his storied career, is win an individual time trial. I think I'm right in saying that. So, you can understand his disappointment on a number of levels there, but he really did go all out and really went for the win, as you'd have to from the off. Nothing you can do when Pogacar is in that sort of mood. Tobias Foss for Netcompany Ineos, rounding out the top three on the day.
Yeah, and then the final stage, I mean, a short race, short stages. This was an absolute brute. I mean, they started halfway up the climb, or, two-thirds of the way up the climb. So it was climbing right from the start, and a real up-down day, a hard climb that they tackled twice in full and then climbed up to the finish line where they'd started earlier. I think perhaps a little bit too hard, actually, that course. I mean, it gave us the result we were all expecting. But again, it was an entertaining race, wasn't it? Because the break was away and they put up a pretty good fight. The last man standing was Lenny Martinez of Bahrain Victorious. And I mean, I was cheering him on. You know, I don't often get...
I don't often get
sort of wrapped up in, you know, who I want to win. But it did feel like, you know, he was up against it. Pogacar attacked the GC group. I mean, was there a GC group? I mean, really, he was the only rider on GC, wasn't he? He attacked at the bottom of the final climb and just gradually reeled Martinez in. And the final moment, the inevitable happened about 900 metres from the line, and Pogacar went past. No mercy, no gifts. Lenny Martinez was looking quite tired and pretty ragged by that point. But like I say, a lot of hard, steep climbing. A beautiful looking course as well. I mean, the countryside in Switzerland looks immaculate. Really well designed, well thought out race. And if we'd had any reservations about the Tour de Suisse being kind of decaffeinated slightly because it's been reduced in length by a few days, I mean, what would we have learned from another three or four stages? Probably not much. Pogacar, instead of winning it by 6 minutes 32 ahead of Richard Carapaz, probably would have won by sort of 10 or 12 minutes if they'd had another couple of mountain stages. So an absolute annihilation of the competition for Pogacar, and clearly he is the man to beat at the Tour de France. I think we can come to that conclusion. There was some doubt, wasn't there? Jonas Vingegaard won the Giro d'Italia in impressive style, but it was very much a kind of salami tactics, wasn't it? Just slice by slice, never doing too much, but head and shoulders above the rest of the competition that was there in Italy. Paul Sexas is still a big question mark over him now because of the difficult week he had at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. Remco Evenepoel, we really don't know too much about at this stage. Pogacar is, I think, the head and shoulders favourite for the Tour de France. But we go into the Tour with still so many questions to answer. But it might be a bit of a how done it rather than a who done it again this year.
Yeah, no particular stop press here with the Pogacar prediction. Lenny Martinez said afterwards he thought if he had 10 or 15 more seconds, then he thought he might have been able to hold on for the win on that final climb. But then if he'd had 10 or 15 more seconds, then I think we'd have seen Pogacar launch that little bit earlier or put that little bit more in. Because I think you're right when you say that Pogacar's ascent was quite controlled. It was a seated ascent, you know, as is typical of him. But even to the point where he kind of pulled up in behind Lenny Martinez before he then and waited a few seconds to kind of regather himself before he launched that sort of final punch for the line. But it was hardly like he had to go all in to be able to do it. It was like he was in sort of fourth gear and had a little bit left in the tank and was able to, you know, Martinez said he needed 10 or 15 more seconds, but Pogacar, as he crossed the line, was able to do that sort of one side kind of high fives with the crowd and then swerve over to the other side of the road and high fives with the crowd behind the barrier on the other side and really kind of take in that third stage win of the week, but that overall win too.
Yeah, when he was doing the high fives with both hands, one side and then the other, I thought, oh, I hope you get on the hand sanitizer when you get back to the warm down zone. Today, because you don't want to catch anything from grubby members of the public a week or a week and a half out from the Tour de France. What else did we learn? I mean, we learned that everybody else is kind of trailing in his wake, really. Richard Carapaz will go to the Tour as the leader, the GC leader for EF Education Easy Post, I guess. You know, Matthias Vacek will add a lot to a very strong-looking little Trek lineup. Ilan Van Wilder's looking good for Sudal Quickstep. You know, Brandon McNulty is another one of these machines for UAE Team Emirates. He was in sixth place overall.
Matthew Riccitiello as
well. Well, currently not on the decathlon long list for the Tour, which surprises me. He didn't finish the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. Because he was sick beforehand, wasn't he? He had food poisoning, so slotted in the Tour de Suisse. Currently, his programme, the next race on it is the 1st of August, the San Sebastian Classic, and then the Vuelta. I think it might be one of those toss of a coin selections for Decathlon when they come to put together their team. You know, they've got Olaf Coy to consider now, and we'll probably talk about the other riders who are tuning up to the Tour de France elsewhere in the next part. But I think there's still some fascinating selection dilemmas for some of the teams.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Saily, the eSIM brought to you by the people behind NordVPN to keep you connected when you're travelling abroad and, most importantly, reduce the cost of using your mobile phone when you're outside your home country. Because let's face it, whether you're travelling for work or on holiday, you probably want to keep using your mobile phone as if you would at home, whether that's browsing the internet to find some great restaurants for dinner, keeping in touch with friends and family, posting on social media, or even downloading your favourite podcast. All of that data can add up and the roaming charges can quickly escalate. A Saily app eliminates all of that because the app only needs to be downloaded once and then you select the right plan covering the country or countries that you're travelling to. It's not like the old days when you had to buy a physical SIM card from the airport and then replace it in your phone. All of that faff has gone. Just download the Saily app in your app store. Find it by searching Saily, S-A-I-L-Y, or go to saily.com/cycling and use the code cycling at checkout to get an exclusive 15% discount off your first Saily data plan. There's 24/7 support, and in the unlikely event that it doesn't work with your device, you can get a full refund too. So stay connected when you're on the move with Saily.
Well, Lionel, I mentioned at the top that we are a week out from departing, or a little over a week out from departing for Barcelona. Now's maybe a good time to mention that our three-part preview, our cycling podcast three-part preview for this year's tour will be coming next week, starting with?
Well, we've got a focus on the big two, haven't we? Tadej Pogacar, Jonas Vingegaard, two journalists who followed their careers very closely. Andy McGrath, who wrote the biography of Tadej Pogacar. Graham, you spoke to him. And I'll be speaking to Brian Nygaard, who follows Jonas Vingegaard's career very closely, as they're both Danish. Brian writes in the Danish sports media and, of course, was at the Giro d'Italia witnessing a lot of Vingegaard's march to glory there, completing the triple crown of Tour, Vuelta and Giro Grand Tour GC victories before Tadej Pogacar. So Jonas Vingegaard has a, well, he's chalked one up there, hasn't he? But it's going to be interesting to hear about their different characters, their preparation for the race, where they stand now. So we'll focus on the big two in episode one, and the other two episodes will cover everybody else and everything else. And then we'll also look at the route, what's on the menu, and try and highlight some of the stages that are unmissable. The kind of weekday stages, if you're thinking about taking a day off work to watch a whole day of the Tour de France, or perhaps if you're travelling over. Well, if you're travelling over, you've probably made your plans and put your accommodation, everything by now.
Yeah, fair play if you're freeform jazzing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why not? Well, we may be at points. There's still a couple of gaps on our itinerary, isn't there, Graham? We need to book a couple of hotels, but otherwise we'll be sleeping in the car or camping on a roundabout.
We're not doing that again.
Never had to do that. So, our preview week next week, before we arrive in Catalonia, episode one of our XL Tour preview will go out on Tuesday. Another couple of things that I just wanted to flag up for Friends of the Podcast subscribers, because thank you to all of our Friends of the Podcast. Your support enables us to go to the Tour de France and cover the race on the ground. Very grateful to you for supporting us financially. If you'd like to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and sign up for a year. You can listen to the whole back catalogue of Kilometre Zero episodes. There'll be a whole programme of Kilometre Zero episodes coming through the tour. I've just bumped up a couple of old episodes from the archive to the top of the feed that people might want to listen to get in the Tour de France mood. They're from our series My First Tour, which we recorded during lockdown. And the first episode, François Thomazeau talks about his first experiences watching the Tour de France on TV as a French person, you know, growing up with the Tour as part of the national culture and heritage and the summer routine and rhythm of a French summer. And he also focuses on the 1986 Tour, which was the first that he covered as a journalist. Very memorable stories of kind of parachuting in halfway through. And my episode of My First Tour is from 20 years ago this summer. Pulls me up quite short to realise two decades have gone past since 2006. It wasn't actually my first tour. I first covered the tour in 1999, but 2006 was the first year I did from start to finish. And we covered it in a camper van. We travelled in a camper van, and it was quite a memorable experience. I talk about that year's race in that episode. So those two episodes, My First Tour, are on the Friends of the Podcast feed. Now, if you're a new subscriber, you might not have listened to them before. And if you've been subscribing for a long while, you might want to give them a re-listen as we head towards the Tour de France.
How many of you in the camper van?
At its worst, three. There was three of us in there. It was hot. We made a very early decision not to use the chemical toilet. That was the rule. So we didn't use the chemical toilet.
It's like being in prison. You're not allowed to use the toilet in the cell.
Yeah, it was great fun, but I don't think we necessarily got as close to the tour as we do these days, Graham. You know, we were lagging behind a bit. The camper van itself was quite slow over the ground. You know, we had to kind of find campsites, hook up to the electricity to charge up laptops and things. Wi-Fi wasn't as reliable and prevalent as it is now, so we were stopping at hotels to use the Wi-Fi in hotels. And yeah, there were some real highlights of those. We did it again in 2007. I think that was enough. There were some real highlights.
Going up the climbs must have been interesting in the camper.
Yeah, a big vehicle. The crowds were big and, you know, crowded in. We felt a bit out of place at times, you know, like we should perhaps have been at the back of the publicity caravan or something. It was an experience that I'm really glad that we did, But I think it taught me a lot about the tour, really, and the way that the people interact with the tour, because we were in and out of the race, if you like. You know, some days we were driving on the course, some days we were doing the big detour to get round. You know, we were going to some starts and finishes and the press room occasionally, but it was a real sense of seeing the Tour de France from, you know, multiple different directions in the space of 3 weeks. And of course, it was an incredible event for a journalist, because there was the Operation Puerto drug bust, which erupted on the eve of the race in Strasbourg. You know, all of the favourites were kicked out before the start of the race. Ivan Basso, Jan Ulrich, Alexander Vinokourov, and so on. A whole list of them kicked out. So it was an incredible race to cover as a journalist, and to witness, you know, the just the drama and the tension and the controversy of it all. So some happy memories. And, well, I try to kind of convey what that race was like with the help of a blog that I wrote at the time. So I read out sections of the blog that I wrote at the time, which, I mean, you can perhaps trace through that blog my own kind of mental unravelling as the race unfolds, because there were some testing days, I can tell you.
Yeah, no doubt. Some testing days for the sprinters for us to move on to at the Baloise Belgium Tour. So while the climbers are sort of dotted around, or were dotted around, Switzerland and Slovenia, we're going to move to the comparative flatlands of Belgium. And, well, it was shared out between the sprinters for the most part, wasn't it? Binyam Girmay back at the front of a race for the first time since the very beginning of this season. His form, of course, has been hot and cold. Perhaps that's a kind way of putting it, possibly more cold than hot, since he was so dominant at the Tour 2 years ago. But he took the first stage for NSN, beating Tim Melea to the line in the bunch sprint. Melea then got him back on stage two. Well, Girmay didn't feature, did he? But Melea for Soudal Quickstep showed that he is very much at the sharp end of his sprinting capacity. Stage three was not one for the sprinters. I don't know whether were you able to keep up with this at the same time as the Tour of Switzerland, but Alex Aramburu for Cofidis.
There was a lot going on. I mean, Switzerland, Slovenia, Belgium, all broadcast on TV. Too much going on, really. It kind of one of these weeks where the cycling season seems to go completely mad, really. There's a lot to pick up, but to actually focus and watch all of the racing is difficult. I mean, it's all spread a bit too thinly, but the sprinters needed something, didn't they? And they had their opportunities there in Belgium. Alex Aramburu of Cofidis just ahead of Lewis Askey on stage three. And then stage four was won by Olav Koy of Decathlon, beating Melea and Philipsen. And then the final stage, Jasper Philipsen of Alpecin Premier Tech. He won the stage, and that was enough to give him the GC. So you're right, Graham. All the stages were shared out among the sprinters, and it was kind of like one win and then second the next day, and it kind of all rotated around a bit, didn't it? So everyone got a victory.
Anti-Pogacar race, yeah. one for the sprinters, yeah. And everyone had a turn. First time we've had a Belgian winner of the Tour of Belgium for how long? It's recent, reasonably recent memory. Do you want me to give you the answer?
Yes, or
do you want
please.
It's Remco Evenepoel. And in fact, the home riders locked out the podium in 2021. Evenepoel, Yves Lampaert, and Yanni Marchand were the top three overall just 5 years ago. But it's been a little while, not quite as long as the French riders have had to wait to win their home tour. But it was quite nice, wasn't it, that it was all shared out and kind of made each bunch sprint a real kind of point of interest too. And it sets the scene really nicely for the Tour de France too, in that you can't just point to one sprinter and say, well, they will almost certainly be the dominant guy.
No, I think it's interesting, isn't it, because sprinting is it's almost a dying art in World Tour level, isn't it? There's so few genuine sprint stages. I mean, there are a few in the Tour de France. I think we might have to wait a few days until we get up to Pau and Bordeaux, but there will be opportunities for proper bunch sprints at the Tour de France. I think it bodes well that there's a well-matched field of riders. I mean, Philipsen, they're one in GC as a result of the time bonuses predominantly and winning the final stage. But the fact that Philipsen got one, Malia got one, Gamay got one, Olav Koy, who I'm starting to think Decathlon might hedge their bets and take him to the Tour, especially if he's won a few races recently. And
well, I mean, that was why he went to Decathlon in the first place, or one of the major reasons why he chose to leave Visma Elisabike and go to Decathlon was because he would get the opportunity at the biggest races or at the biggest race.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of snuck onto the provisional list of riders recently. So I think that victory in Belgium may well be enough to clinch a place. And it makes perfect sense because it spreads the responsibility and the load. It takes a little bit of pressure off Paul Seksas and it gives them a valid option on those sprint stages, somebody who could win a stage. And it won't be easy because they are all quite well matched. And you've got to also put into the mix the fact that Mathieu van der Poel is a fast finisher and may well try and upset the apple cart a bit as he tried last year with some kind of crazy break. You know, it's not necessarily a given that the stages that we look at as being ones for the sprinters will definitely end in a sprint because we're not really seeing the sprinters' teams dedicate the resources to the chase. It's going to be really interesting to see what the various trends we've seen over the stage races in the recent month. And I'm thinking of the Giro where they didn't get themselves organised early enough to bring in breaks, notably that day in Milan. But we've seen this with tricky climbs at the end of stages and unusual run-ins. It doesn't fall in the way of the sprinters. We're so far away from when I first started watching and covering the Tour, you know, when you'd have four Mario Cipollini wins in a row, or, you know, riders with, or the Mark Cavendish era much more recently, where the sprints would go to one man and one team really got it gripped and sorted. We're seeing a lot more factors in some of these flatter stages. So it'll be interesting to see who comes out on top. And the green jersey battle will be fascinating. You know, Mads Pedersen is, I think, one of the favourites. But the tweak to the points, how the points are going to be awarded with a heavier weighting for the actual flat stages, does tip it back in the favour of the bunch sprinters again. So I think it's going to be great to watch. And I'd much rather have a situation where, you know, several riders have got a chance to win rather than one person winning, you know, all four sprint finishes.
That tweak to the way that points are shared out with the green jersey competition, a nod to the fact that Tadej Pogacar was in with a shout of winning it last year, last time round, and ASO basically saying, look, no, come on, that's a bit silly. We can't have him winning that as well. So I've weighted it with, as you say, much more of a focus on the flatter stages. Fewer flatter stages at the Tour of Slovenia.
Yeah, another lovely looking race, though, and a very good week for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, wasn't it?
It was, and they must be coming into the Tour with a lot of confidence behind, well, I was going to call him their main man, but he won't necessarily be. They will very much be presumably be a two-pronged attack, Remco Evenepoel and Florian Lipowitz. And Lipowitz didn't quite do what Tadej Pogacar did at the Tour de Suisse, but he did come away with two stage wins at the Tour of Slovenia, plus the general classification, winning the overall thanks to those final two stages, thanks to winning outright on stage four and stage five. So I suppose it was, you could maybe say it was a slightly more of a sort of Isaac Del Toro approach at the Not Dauphiné, the Tour of Auvergne Rhône Alpes, in that he waited until everyone else had given all they'd got and kind of floated to the top on those last two climby stages.
Yeah, I mean, not the deepest field, if we're totally honest. I mean, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe had a very strong team. Lawrence Pithy won stages one and three with fast finishes. I mean, he had a teammate, Arne Marit, who was second on the opening stage. Then Lipowitz one ahead of his teammate Giulio Pellizzari on the penultimate stage, and then Lipovits, when he won the final stage and clinched the GC definitively, he was ahead of Lawrence Pithy. So they really wrapped it up. The second stage was won by Dusan Rajovic. It was paused with about 27 kilometers to go briefly because there was a big crash and lots of riders needed treatment, and they couldn't resume the race until the medical staff and the ambulance were clear to keep up with the peloton again. But yeah, a Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe procession, really. I mean, they dominated it. And Florian Lipovits, who was third in the Tour de France last year, there is potentially a bit of a power struggle at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe with Remco Evenepoel. I mean, Evenepoel hasn't raced since Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I mean, he had a strong spring, didn't he? The surprise start at the Tour of Flanders, which ended with third place. He won the Amstel Gold Race and then third in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but behind the big two, Pogacar and Seksas there. Evenepoel and Lipovits have kind of been, they've been on sort of parallel tracks to the Tour, haven't they? Even back at the start of the season when they were riding together in Mallorca, they had a couple of days where they were together, and you know, it was all very much, well, this day for Remco, this day for Lipovits. It'll be very interesting to see how they dovetail and who has the upper hand. They'll be very strong in that opening team time trial, I think, and they'll have enough to be right up there, I would think. But unlike UAE Team Emirates, where there's a very clear hierarchy, Pogacar is being supported by a very, very strong and very dynamic Isaac Del Toro. Evenepoel and Lipovits are much more, it's quite finely balanced between them, and they've got very different skills. And we haven't really seen the best of Remco Evenepoel in the mountains at the Tour de France. I mean, he had a bad time last year, but you know, when it comes to individual time trials, he's you know, he's very strong. The problem for him is that there might not be enough terrain for him to get himself into and stay in contention.
He's almost having a complete opposite build up to what he had last year. And he said after he pulled out of the Tour that he was always playing catch up, going from the classics to altitude camp, then to the Dauphiné, as it was, and then to the Tour, and didn't really feel like he had time to recover properly from that early season injury. Not quite on Evenepoel, is this a good place to mention his old team, Soudal Quickstep, and their press release that you sent me? It's kind of related with a future. I mean, you sent the screen grab to me with the words, "If this guy doesn't win the Tour one day," and the guy in question is Simon de France, 18-year-old Simon de France, who... we started this episode talking about a 70 kilometer break from the current Tour de France champion, but it was the Vuelta al Bisaya, and it was a 70 kilometer break, the longest solo move in the history of the race, that meant it was a 1-2 for Soudal Quickstep, their under 19 team anyway, on the opening day of the Vuelta al Bisaya.
Yeah, a young French rider, Simon de France. Well, we could have in a few years' time. I mean, he's only 18, so he's even younger than Paul Seksas, but maybe we'll have Seksas and de France at the Tour de France one day. Who knows?
Nominative determination there.
Indeed.
Always good to see it.
Indeed. A couple of other races. Tom Pidcock scratched from the Tour de Suisse because he had a viral infection, which disrupted his training ahead of the race. And so he and his team, Pinarello Q36.5, decided not to do the five-day Tour de Suisse, but instead target the Andorra Morabank Classic as a final tune-up for the Tour de France. And, well, he won it ahead of Carlos Verona and Sepp Kuss. So Pidcock looking decent ahead of the Tour de France, and he'll be a factor at some point, won't he? Maybe targeting stage wins is more realistic than a high overall finish this year. Who knows? But a handy
one
victory
may follow the other too.
Indeed, we shall see.
I was going to ask you in our build up to the Tour on the fourth episode of Attitude Camp, what one thing are you packing that you can't go without for this time round, or what when we were out last year together, what did you miss that you sort of thought should have brought that with me?
Well, it's something that I packed last year and didn't use once, which was my running shoes. This year, I'm determined to actually get out early enough in the morning and get a few kilometres under my belt, because I think it sets me up better for the day if I've had a bit of a move about. If it's baking hot, I might have to go quite early, but I've just never managed to be consistent over 3 weeks, Graham, with the running. So this year, I've set myself a little program of which days, when we've got a logistically less demanding start, perhaps when we've got too far to drive to the start, and on the days when the stages start late. I mean, they all start pretty late these days. The sort of average start time for a stage is about 1:30 in the afternoon, which in theory should give you loads of time in the morning, but it never seems to, does it? I remember the first tours I covered, stages starting at sort of 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, that was an endurance test, but there's no excuse these days. I should be able to get up and out sort of 7:30, do a half hour run, and then enjoy my brioche baguette and croissant trio at breakfast, and then we're off and running for the day.
Now you can rate your breakfast with some authority now too. The Flaneurs Run Club, maybe we should christen it. And in fact, I should give Richard Abraham some credit. That was what he was calling his early morning runs a couple of years ago.
How about you?
I think the AeroPress, again, another more credit to Richard, actually. That was one of the things that he bought with him at the 2024 tour. And I was so impressed with the quality of coffee that he was able to make with just the addition of some hot water, having bought everything else along with him, that I shall be doing the same this year. So you're the boulanger and I will be the barista for our 3 weeks in France.
Excellent. Well, we've got it all covered then, Graham. We shall reconvene next week as we build up. The picture will all start to come together, won't it, as the teams start finalising their team lineups. Of course, National Championship weekend this weekend. These days feels like it gets overlooked a little bit. It's not quite the same big fixture on the calendar that it used to be. It used to be a place where teams were still weighing up who to take to the tour. You know, a good result in the National Championships might be the clinching factor, but it doesn't seem to be the case so much anymore, and a lot of the big stars miss their championships. Sam Watson
was possibly that was possibly the clinching thing for Ineos to take him last year, the British champion, and you could see how much that meant to him as he crossed the line with his celebrations.
Sure, I'm thinking more of like the bigger nations of where, you know, say in France, you know, a team, the equivalent of say a Groupama, would take, you know, 20 riders, 15 of whom are still in with a shout, and it might impact the racing. But the National Championships, I think, you know, one of these other things that probably needs a bit of a rejig. I don't think it serves the National Championships that well that the race is held a week before the Tour de France. I think it's a bit too close and it gets lost a little bit. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's a huge motivating factor for some riders. If they win their national jersey and can then show it off in the Tour de France, it's where it can make or break a season, a career even. It can secure a new contract. So we'll keep an eye on who's going to be getting togged up in some national colours at the Tour de France. We'll see who wins the time trials and road races over the duration of the rest of the week, won't we?
We will. Looking forward to that enormously. And with that, unless there was any other business, we will say farewell for now, and we're looking forward to when we speak next week. It will be the week on which the Tour de France begins. It's felt like it's a long time coming. Very, very exciting.
Yeah, we hope everyone's looking forward to joining us as we travel from Barcelona to Paris. We've been covering the Tour on the ground since 2013. I don't know how many years that makes it for the Cycling Podcast. It'll be my 23rd tour, I think. Graham, your
fourth from start to finish.
Excellent. So we're looking forward to it immensely. We're delighted to have you along for the journey. We're well outside the time limit again here, Graham. Come on, we need to get sharper, or we're going to get left behind before the race even reaches France.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brought to you by the Capital One Saver Card. With Saver, you earn unlimited 3% cash back on dining, entertainment, and at grocery stores. That's unlimited cash back on ordering takeout from home or unlimited cash back on tickets to concerts and games. So grab a bite, grab a seat, and earn unlimited 3% cash back with the Saver Card. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.